From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. The last hour of the program tonight, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment, Giants and Moon-Eyed People. Sounds like one of those coast-to-coast moments, doesn't it? Here's what's happening. A meteorite that we talked about that crashed through a Virginia doctor's office last month is now igniting a legal debate over just who owns this valuable rock. The half-a-pound space rock landed January 18th, crashing through the roof of the Lorton, Virginia building and cracking into a few pieces when it hit the ground. No one was hurt. Shortly after it was recognized as a space rock, the doctors gave it to the nearby Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, which offered $5,000 in return. Now, the doctors say they plan to donate the money to Haiti to the Emergency Relief Fund there. But the plot thickens. The landlords of the building where the meteorite landed, they're claiming the doctors had no right to give the rock away, and they want it back. A meteorite dealer, his name is Robert Haig, has told the Washington Post that the Lorton rock could fetch $50,000. That's more than the rent they probably get. The China-U.S. diplomatic spat over cyber attacks on Google has highlighted the growing significance of the Internet as a theater of combat. The Deputy Defense Secretary, William Lin, recently warned of its appeal to foes who are unable to match the U.S.'s conventional military might. An enemy, for example, could deploy hackers to take down U.S. financial systems, communications, and infrastructure. And he suggested this could be done at a cost far below that of building a trillion-dollar fleet of fifth-generation jet fighters, for example. But what U.S. officials don't like to acknowledge is that the Pentagon is hard at work developing right now an offensive cyber capability of its own. In fact, it has even begun using the capability to wage war beyond merely shutting down enemy systems. In Berlin, a woman admiring the sunset on a tourist webcam in northern Germany spotted a man who was lost on the frozen North Sea and probably saved this guy's life by alerting authorities. The man had climbed over a pack of ice off the coast to photograph a sunset near the town of St. Peter Ording, and then became disoriented on the ice. He didn't know where he was. Unable to locate the beach, the man began using his camera to flash for help. Well, that got the attention of no one other than a woman hundreds of miles away in southern Germany who was watching the sunset over the sea by her computer. The area is a popular tourist destination known for its beaches and sailing, and the local tourism board runs a website through a webcam, and she spotted the flashing. Isn't that an amazing story? If you are reading food labels for ingredients, I just want you to know about one called Amino Sweet. It is a low-calorie aspartame sweetener, tastes like sugar, they say, but they won't say aspartame on the label. They'll say Amino Sweet. So just be on guard for that. Actor David Prowse, who starred as Darth Vader in the original Star Wars films, well, he's in remission from prostate cancer. The 74-year-old says that he was given the all clear last month after being diagnosed a year before. Prowse said that he made a full recovery after intensive radiotherapy at a London hospital. How about that? Astronomers have used a new ground-based technique to study the atmospheres of planets outside of our solar system. The work could assist the search for Earth-like planets with traces of organic or carbon-rich molecules. Astronomers spotted evidence of methane gas in the atmosphere of an exoplanet. They're going to find one day and probably will have life on it. You know, the Internet right now has been abuzz with rumors about an apparent Earth-sized object appearing near the sun in some NASA images. And some individuals have even gone so far as to identify the civilizations that these planetary-sized motherships have come from. But, according to NASA, these are indeed video artifacts that have appeared as a result of a failure in the Deep Space Central data recorder. So it's causing all these images in resolution. Physicist Nassim Haramein talks a lot about interesting topics in his lectures, and he explains often how UFOs may be using the sun as a stargate. And, well, this may explain all the recent NASA SOHO sun UFO images, maybe. Another interesting part of his work, of course, how Mexican authorities have had to change the approach route for airlines due to ongoing UFO interactions. But I want to get right to the source. So we're going to be talking with physicist Nassim Hedamain in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Looking forward to this chat tonight with physicist Nassim Hedamain. He has spent most of his life researching the geometry of hyperspace, theoretical physics, cosmology, quantum mechanics, biology, chemistry. Sounds like a song, doesn't it? As well as anthropology and ancient civilizations. Combining the knowledge with a keen observation of the behavior of nature, he discovered a specific geometric array that he found to be the fundamental to creation, and the foundation for his unified theory has emerged. And Mr. Hedamain founded a not-for-profit organization called the Resonance Project, where, as the director of research, he continues exploring unification principles and their implications in our world today. And we're going to talk with him about many of these subjects tonight on Coast to Coast. Nassim, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be on the show again. I've been good.
I have been flooded with emails since you were with me in August of last year. I mean, they continue to roll in.
I'm glad. People are very interested, and it's very exciting to see, you know, so much people with good ideas and people thinking for themselves.
Absolutely. Tell me about this internet buzz. What's going on here? What have you said about it specifically? I mean, they're running all over the place saying that there's a UFO going around the sun. I want to get your take on this.
Well, you know, it's been a long journey for me to, you know, of observing the sun. It started really when I was doing a lot of studying of ancient civilization.
Mm-hmm.
I found that, like, all these civilizations around the world were talking about sun gods and talking about them in terms of, you know, using the sun in some kind of stargate or in some kind of way of traveling through the universe in many different cultures around the world. And they're very similar stories, and they're very coherent, and they seem to describe a very specific way the universe works and a very specific way we can travel in it. And so, you know, I started to pay more and more attention to the sun. And in 1998, I came across a video that came from the SOHO probe where there was two objects that seemed to be solar-gazing comets that seemed to crash into the sun. And I analyzed the video carefully and found that there was some anomaly in the movements of those comets along their path towards the sun. And then, as well, you know, they didn't have tails that seemed to be long enough for the comet's size they were, and so on.
Yeah.
And so I started to really pay attention to a lot of the information that's available to us from the SOHO probes and various other telescopes. And as I did that, I realized that I wasn't the only one that was paying attention to the sun. And it turned out that it seemed like a very large institution, one of the wealthiest and most powerful institution on our planet, the Vatican, was actually spending a lot of time and a lot of energy looking at our sun itself.
They have been all over the map, haven't they?
They have. And, you know, so in 1998, I started to publicly talk about this. I showed the videos in my seminars, and I talked to people about it, and I talked to various experts about it, and I got information from insiders inside JPL and others. And, you know, I found very, very interesting data that seemed to show that there is activity around the sun that cannot be easily explained by conventional means. And, you know, this is a question of opinion, and, you know, it's the result of all the research I've done, but it really looks very anomalous in many cases.
Now, one of the reasons why these theories abound, do you think it's because it's very difficult to get great pictures near the sun because it blots things out?
Yes, you know, the sun is a very energetic system, obviously. It's 99.8% the mass of our solar system. All the planets together don't even make 1% the mass of the sun. So it's, and it's very energetic. There's a lot of difficulties in analyzing the sun. You know, even like things that are simple that you'd think we know about the sun. For instance, its rate of rotation. We have a pretty good idea of its rate of rotation. However, because it is a plasma sphere, there's different rate of rotation around the equator and others, you know, as you go up the latitude. So even something simple as the, you know, the rate of rotation of the sun, or, you know, many dynamics that we see on the sun, for instance, the missing neutrino issues and so on, have crop up in our physics throughout the years. And, you know, observing the sun demands very expensive probes out there that are taking a beating with a lot of solar particle hitting the cameras and the lens. And so there's a lot of artifacts that comes up on these reels, on these videos, on these pictures that are taken of the sun by these probes. So it's very difficult to make a distinction between artifacts that are like particles hitting the lens, or you know, various compression and decompression issues that occur with resolution issue and so on, and genuine unexplainable objects mm-hmm. that seem to show up around the sun at times.
So are you saying that what might be going on around the sun could be objects of extraterrestrial origin?
It could be. I believe so. And I'm saying this not really lightly. I mean, it is a question of opinion. However, it is from, you know, not just from observation of the sun over a period of, you know, 15 years that have been, but as well from an intense and deep study in ancient civilization and this thread that one can follow when studying ancient texts and ancient cultures around the world that talks about these advanced beings that seem to have visited our planet thousands and thousands of years ago. I mean, it's in most of the ancient traditions, and that talks about their use of the sun, you know, and their mode of traveling, their power source, looking like a little sun, and so on. And so I think there's something very, very significant there, and I think it's really, at this point in history, it's unveiling very rapidly.
Now, with a physicist with your notoriety, Nassim, you've got to be driving some of the old-line physicists nuts with some of these theories. What do you hear?
Definitely, you know, it's definitely my opinions there diverge widely from the main views. However, you'd be surprised when you talk to physicists around the world how many physicists, you know, will concede that there most likely is life out there, and that it's not impossible that these, you know, that advanced civilization out there. I mean, when you look at our evolution, in 150 years, barely, we've gone from horse and buggy to the moon and so on, and we're flying in airplanes and all this. Imagine a civilization out there that has 1,000 years of advanced technological development. You know, they could think of traveling across the galaxy just the way we think of taking a charter plane
sure.
from here to Australia.
Or even 1,000,000 years ahead of us.
That's
My
right.
My gosh.
Yeah, and 1,000,000 years, very good. 1,000,000 years is not much in cosmological time.
No,
I mean,
nothing.
It's a blink of an eye.
Yeah, drop in the bucket.
That's right. And so people with that type of advancements in technology may think of moving across the galaxy, or even from one galaxy to another, or a universe from one universe to another, as something they do casually every day. And so, you know, I think it's really important that we don't limit our minds and our scope by thinking that we must be the most advanced people out there, and that it's not possible for other people to come here because we can't go there. That's not an accurate assessment.
Now, what about this story about Mexican airlines are being told to avoid certain areas in in the air to stay away from UFOs.
Yes, well, you know, in Mexico, there's been a lot of UFO activity, especially since the eclipse of 1990. Interestingly, you know, the increase in UFO activity was so tremendous at one point that the Mexican government pretty well straight up admitted that there was an issue in the air, in their airspace, and that they needed to start training pilots and radio tower controllers to be able to steer around the frequently flown route that these UFOs seems to utilize all the time in the region of Mexico City. And so, you know, all that happened quite a bit of time ago. But, you know, a lot of that information, unless you dig for it, doesn't really make it into the United States. So, since then, the Mexican government has admitted to having UFO encounters. They've released, actually, you know, Air Force footage of filming UFOs and so on. And many other countries around the world, too, has started to release files. And there's very active groups all around the world that are led by very credible people, astronauts and military personnel and so on. They're all coming forward, including the Vatican, which is what is quite remarkable.
Yeah, something's weird going on there, Nassim, isn't there?
There is. I think we're approaching a very important time in our history where we may finally encounter civilization outside of our solar system.
Are you familiar with the work of Zachariah Sitchin, by any chance?
I am.
Okay. And, of course, for those who don't, and Zachariah was just our guest, and, you know, he contends that 400,000 years ago, beings from another planet in our solar system called Nibiru, which is on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit, came to this planet in search of gold. They needed it for their atmosphere to protect it. And they genetically altered the creatures who were on this planet at the time that eventually became us. And he said he was able to decide of this by interpreting Sumerian, Iraqian templates at the time in text. What do you think of that theory?
I think Zachariah Sitchin got a lot of things right, and I think that in some way, in some areas, he made an interpretation that I don't necessarily agree with, one of the assertions he makes about this planet X that I believe actually was mistranslated from planet to comet. And you find in many other cultures around the world this concept of this killer comet that comes through the solar system once in a while. And so I think that when you actually look globally at all the different texts, you get a better picture and a more complete picture of what was going on there. So it's hard to tell. I mean, it depends on the interpretation of the text. And for sure, you know, many of these texts are written in very ancient languages that are very difficult to decode, and much of it has to do with the interpretation of them. Some of the texts I'm involved with right now that I'm very excited about are texts that come from ancient Indian cultures and Tamil cultures that come from, you know, the Vedic tradition and so on, that talk about extraterrestrials and flying machines and so on.
Absolutely. I mean, ancient texts, artwork depict craft. How would they come up with this thousands of years ago?
Exactly. Even the concept of a flying machine should have been, no pun intended, alien to a civilization thousands and thousands of years ago. I mean, some of the texts that I'm examining I have a little section on my videos about that, are thought to be dated 13,900 years old. You're talking civilizations that should have been in the dark ages of humanity evolution, people that should have been in caves, barely out of caves, And, you know, for them to describe flying machines and very complex steering capabilities of these machines and complex mechanism to make them fly is remarkable. And you really don't expect that from ancient texts.
We're going to come back with you, Nassim, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And by the way, webmaster Lex has posted on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com pictures, a link of that UFO sun. Pretty amazing stuff, actually. Pretty amazing indeed. And, you know, you can go over there and become one of our Twitter friends. So just get up there to coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment at Coast to Coast AM. Are you a Streamlink member? Well, you can be for just pennies a day. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com. You can get podcasts, past archives, 3 years right now, going back even further, iPhone apps, and some other little things that you'll have some fun. It's just a neat way to be part of Coast to Coast AM, and I think it's just really pennies a day. We'll be back in a moment with physicist Nassim Hedamain on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with physicist Nassim Hedamain. Nassim, last night, Coast to Coast guest Richard Hoagland, who's a regular contributor and our science advisor as well, heads up the enterprisemission.com. Yes. He claimed that that spiral in Norway was the remnants of fuel from a grabbed, captured Russian missile that he believes a shadow government, I'm going to use that a shadow government has incredible technology that could down a missile, capture it, that they wanted the world to really know what they were doing and the clout they did have. What are your thoughts on that thing?
Well, that's very interesting. I hadn't heard that one, but I don't know. It's a very difficult analysis. You know, there's so much information out there. And when we look at the footage and the information that's available, it's a very difficult thing to decipher and to try to come to a positive deterministic conclusion. However, you know, I tend towards from the analysis I've made, from the studies I've done, and from my understanding of certain levels of technologies that we have, most likely the phenomenon that's seen over Norway is the result of a ground facility that has an array of antennas, best known as the HARP.
Know it well, the one in Alaska, and there's also one out that area, right?
That's right. There's one right near that area, atmospheric heating facility. And, when you look at the footage, you look at the rotational dynamics of these spirals and the dynamics you see that seem to go to a ground effect and then there's all sorts of information that supports that. For instance, large surges in their power consumption during that time, during that night, those plots are available and so on from that facility, and various effects that were observed from other HARP phenomena prior to this incident that were very similar to a similar effect. I think that it all starts to add up, and it's pretty conclusive. But there's no way that we can absolutely say what, in my case anyway, what has happened there. But I think it all points to that direction. And in one way, I'm a little, it's kind of a pinch in the heart if this is what is happened there, because I think that when the spiral finally dissipates and it opens in what people call a black hole, and, you know, because I do black hole physics,
yeah,
and I deal with all this, I got a lot of emails. A black hole occurred over Norway and all this. And when I looked at it, and knowing what these devices do to the ionosphere, I believe that the dissipation that occurred when the black hole opened is actually a hole being poked in our ionosphere. And that's why the energy actually dissipated.
What about CERN? CERN's been active lately. Is it possible something's going wrong there?
You know, it's you mean the Hadron Collider?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's been a very difficult project. It's been plagued with difficulties from the beginning. You know, it's a very highly powerful accelerator. I'm actually surprised that not all of Europe dims when that they turn that thing on. But, you know, it is a very difficult thing to do, what they're trying to do there. And so they've had various difficulties every time they turn it on. There's various things that happen that makes it impossible for them to finish the tests. So, you know, the energy levels, I think, are higher than what was anticipated. So, for instance, in the first instance, some of the anchors that held some of the magnetic coils ripped out, and some of the parts went flying through the accelerator and damaged the detectors and so on. And so there's been problems all over this experiment.
Bird drop bread in there and everything else.
Yes, that's right. So there's been difficulties, but I think we're getting there slowly but surely. I believe that what they're going to find is going to be quite unusual, that they're going to be quite surprised at what they find there, and that we're going to learn a whole lot about a whole new level of physics from these experiments.
As long as they don't create a black hole on us, Nassim. You know?
Well, you see, my theory, George, says that every atom is already a mini black hole.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not too worried about it. You know, the geometry of the experiment, the dynamics they're using, if they create anything close to what I believe is a singularity, which is basically an atom, as far as I'm concerned,
yeah.
You know, I think that it's going to be short-lived and dissipate quite fast because the geometry is not quite right.
Well, Nassim, what do you think is really happening with HARP? I mean, what are they doing over there with these things?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. HARP has been a project that has been ongoing for a fairly long time now. There's obviously facilities in many different countries around the world, and there is, you know, what are they using HARP to do is difficult to answer. You know, most people are not privy to this level of information. And but, you know, people ask me, well, if you believe they're poking holes in the ionosphere, why would they be doing that? You know, is it just because they want to demonstrate their power or so on? And I believe, and, you know, at the end of the day, and this is really, again, you know, an opinion and a conclusion I've come to just because, you know, from the studies I've made, maybe our governments are trying to reduce global heating by, you know, removing some of the blanketing that our ionosphere produced.
Because this thing must be on 24/7, you know? They must have the switch on all the time.
Mm. Well, you know, it's hard to say, but certainly, you know, that could be a reason why they're poking holes and trying to allow some of the heat to escape. So there might be humanitarian reasons.
Absolutely. We've had Nick Begich on the program, who was one of the first to publicize HARP, which stands for the High Frequency Active Oral Research Program. And what they say on their own website is that it's a scientific endeavor aimed at studying the properties and behavior of the ionosphere with an emphasis on understanding and enhancing communications and surveillance systems for civilian and defense purposes. Now, what the heck does that mean?
Well, you know, there's many reasons why you would want to bulge the ionosphere and be able to control one of those bulges. You know, for instance, it would provide you a means to communicate across the horizon, meaning that instead of bouncing a signal across to a satellite, which is a weak link in the defense system, you know, and then bouncing it back further across the horizon on the Earth, if you could bulge the ionosphere in such a way that you can use it as a reflective lens to send a signal across the ionosphere, across the atmosphere and across the horizon, then, you know, it would be an advantageous device for communication in military industrial complex. So, you know, that is probably what they're thinking of when they're describing this on their website, communication and surveillance done without the satellite structure, but actually directly from the ionospheric bulge. Then there's many other things you might be able to do. Like I said, you know, you might be able to create, you know, anomalies in which you're able to release some of the greenhouse effects that are occurring on our planet, or you may be able to modify weather or do things that, you know, military complex industry, you know, look for in their development.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. But whatever it is, I just have a feeling that it's a little more sinister than they present it to be.
Yes. Well, you know, in general, the whole concept of defense, which in general should be called offense in our planet, you know, is sinister in general. I wish humans would get along a little better.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've got to get up to the enterprisemission.com website. I'm curious when you have some time, and Nassim, to just to read Richard Hoagland's analysis mm-hmm. of the Norway spiral. He talks a little bit about HARP in that, too.
Yes, and, it's very interesting. I'd love to study it more and see what he concluded to.
Tell me a little bit more about your theories of fractals in geometry and what that means to all of us.
Well, you know, early on in my evolution, I started to realize that maybe we couldn't just account for our reality, like all the atoms that makes up our body and everything else around us, just with the concept of little billiard balls we call atoms that are flying around, that there may be a deeper fractal reality that's occurring. And what I mean by that, you know, there's not really an God particle. There's not really a smallest particle that makes up all our reality, that the smaller particle could be divided again and divided again and divided again, and that if we kept on building larger and larger accelerators, we'd get smaller and smaller and smaller particles, and that there was no end to it. And when I start to think that way, I realize, well, maybe our reality is made of little singularity, little black holes, because black holes have this infinite nature, this infinite mass, this infinite density at its center. And when I start to explore that and look at the atom with that lens, it started to become evident that this must be the case. I started writing scaling laws, showing that, you know, from universal size. I mean, most people don't know, but our universe obeys the condition of a black hole. If you take the mass of the universe and you put it in the radius that we believe our universe is, and you calculate if that mass-radius relationship obeys the condition of a black hole, it does, meaning light should not be able to escape. So, you know, the idea that we live inside a black hole and that everything inside it are smaller black holes in different scales that we're on the outside of, so we're seeing the radiative dynamic of the outside event horizon of a black hole start to come into my field, and I start to think that way, and I start to write physics that way and mathematics that way, and it all added up to correct predictions in many different ways, eventually bringing me to write this paper, the Schwarzschild proton, which just won an award in Europe, and that described the atom as this mini black hole with infinite density, the nuclei of an atom as a mini black hole. And that really has many implications in physics, but as well in philosophy.
I would love to get your take on why you think we're here and what we are.
Well, that's a large question. But if I would to attempt to answer that, I would say that You know, I think that, I mean, part of the Schwarzschild proton paper is I show that actually the space between things, the vacuum, is not empty, and that inside the proton, there's all the energy available for all protons in the universe. And so that everything is entangled through this web of information across space. The vacuum is actually what connects all things.
It's wireless. You just don't really see it, do you?
That's right. And you don't experience it because, just like a good example, just like a wireless router, you know, gives you internet, but you don't necessarily experience it directly. You know, this vacuum energy is present everywhere, and it's a little bit of a reversal from the common thinking that the material world defines the space. Then I start to think maybe the space defines the material world. And when I start to think that way, I start to see that relationship between all things, and the math started to support it. You know, it leads you to realize that maybe this great adventure we're on is actually a feed from the whole universe, that like, and the multiverse and the megaverse, that we're on the very end of this fractal structure of space. Looking back at ourselves, looking back at the universe, and learning about ourselves, that like it's a whole network of information that we're part of, and that we're not actually isolated, but we're part of this amazing will works of nature, and we're like little probes learning and exploring the universe from our own very specific perspective.
Could you say at this point, based on what you've been putting together all these years as a physicist, first and foremost, that there's got to be some design behind all of this, that it just didn't happen by a roll of the dice?
Yeah, you know, I think absolutely. I don't believe in the roll of the dice, and certainly Einstein made very famous statements about this as well. I think that like it's a self-organizing system that, you know, it shows that the universe is actually learning about itself, and as it learns about itself, the information that it gathers coalesce and synergize to produce the next set of questions, which are now answered again, and then so on and so on, like in a feedback of information network. So the system self-organizes. You know, you're really asking a question about God. And in this view, God is everything. Everything, you know, interacting with everything is learning about itself and self-organizing, making very, very complex system in very short amount of times, which is a big problem in science. We can't really explain how, you know, the complexity of our biosphere occurred, you know, and so well organized. I mean, it's an amazing thing. Even one human being is quite remarkable. If you take all the DNA in one human being and you wrap it around the world, you can wrap it 5 million times. It's, you know, that's all the information compactified inside yourself to make you actually work and a very coordinated way for a long period of time. And so this level of organization, I believe, is the result of self-organizing feedback structure that's present in the space-time structure right around you right now in the vacuum.
And it's probably, if there are multiverses, and you think there are two, that it could be the same throughout?
Yes, it could be the same throughout in like various scales, and actually my scaling laws, the papers I published showing scaling laws seem to show that there's very specific, very complementary and similar dynamics that are occurring from universal size all the way down to subatomic particles, and that there's a fundamental physics that unifies all this, and that's been my great adventure.
Still to come, more with Nassim Hedamain on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back.